This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, we hear from Beth Belmont, who discusses topics from her book, When Two Spines Align, Dressage Dynamics. And we also have part two of the two-part series, consisting of excerpts from the interviews taken with Michael Poulin and Gunter Seidel, who trained and rode the 2000 Rimmer Foundation USDF Hall of Fame inductee Graf George, who is featured in the May edition of the USDF Connection magazine. But first, the USDF would like to remind all USEF dressage judges, L graduates, and those enrolled in USDF L education programs that it's time to renew your access to the L website. The L website has been updated to include information on the changes to the USEF and USDF tests, as well as the newly enhanced pages on judging freestyle and practice tests for those attending part two of the L program. And to purchase access, please visit the L program page on the website at usdf.org. And now we hear from the two riders who trained and rode the 2000 Rimmer Foundation USDF Hall of Fame inductee, Graf George. And we begin with Michael Poulin, who explains how his relationship with Graf George began.
Meg had an accident, got a severe concussion, and she said, "I bought this horse at an auction. Graf George, he's ballistic. Can you take it? He was 3 years old." And so I took him. I says, "Yep." And he was really explosive. He did two things. That was, he would want to run away and buck. I had two quite severe concussions just from him bucking. Mm-hmm. So he was quite violent. But for me, the hotter and the more explosive they were, the better. I enjoyed it. I really liked the hot horses. I had a lot of success with him because I wasn't in a hurry, and I actually spent 2 years competing him at second level test four, so they had the circle and the simple change of lead, because he was so explosive, he did himself so tight. He actually, if you asked for a five, he'd give you a 10, because it really excited. So I stayed there 2 years with him at second level, and from there, in that process, I had started the Piaf with him about five, because I knew he was difficult. So I just went very easy, made it fun for him. Didn't do too much. Took me about a year and a half to get the Piaf, because he would capriole. It was really difficult. But anyway, George kept coming, and then from second level I went to pre-St. George, and he was still extremely explosive and very, very difficult. And because of it, I remember Rock very often. You got to always do, if you do one line of collection, you got to do two lines of extensions. Get rid of the tension. Let the horse stretch, overstripe, to give the reins. So George was a classic horse. If you saw me warming him up, getting ready for Olympic competition, I'm in long range, posting trot, until he would relax. When he was relaxed and the tension had dissipated, of course I'm all the time sneaking up on him. You know what I mean? Very, very careful. He knew it, but he didn't really get tense. So that really developed. I had quite a rapport with him. He had a hard time with the one tempies. So I think he did his first Grand Prix at 8.5. Which wasn't so bad. And then a very good friend of mine, who's also a very good friend still today, Guy Moomer from Long Island, New York, Riverhead, New York, just an absolute lovely lady who has tremendous vision, says, "Michael, you should own that horse." And so she organized it. And then a very good man who was part of Citibank, Harry Jones, and Dee and Meg became owners of Graf George. Mm-hmm. And I had it. So that how that all went about. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Dee and Meg Hamilton. Thanks to Meg Hamilton, because without Meg Hamilton, we would never have Graf George.
And now Gunter Seidel talks about his partnership with the horse and how it all began with a phone call.
My association with Graf George began when Robert Dover called me and told me that the horse was for sale, and he thought it was a very good match. It was the year before the Olympics, and he thought this would be a good combination. So he asked me to fly out to try the horse, and that was the beginning of that relationship. It's hard when you go and try a Grand Prix horse. It's very hard to get on and immediately make a decision. This is good, this is bad, this works for me. It helped that Robert knew the horse in that instance. And I always tended to like hot horse it, and he was a hot horse. And the first day I rode that horse, I went through the whole Grand Prix, and that was a good indication that I got along with the horse, because usually that will take a few days before you get everything in line. I could get on, and the first day I could actually do the Grand Prix with some mistakes, but I got through it. And that speaks a lot for the horse and the previous training also. It's personally a bad boy. A bad boy with a fun side to him. Always up for a little joke. He never was a mean horse. He would never do anything malicious to you. He loved life. And he was always up for a joke. If he found some excuse to put in a little buck or something, he would do that and always nip on something, or he loved interaction with people. So that's how he was. He was very, very level-headed at home, unless, you know, if you had a truck go by and something made a loud noise, he would explode and do something. But overall, he was a very level-headed horse at home. Because he was not the youngest horse, we were on a very strict program to not do too much with him at home either, to keep his legs in healthy condition and keep him sound and not do too much, because I knew coming towards the show, I always had to increase the work, and at the show itself, I had to work him quite hard. So it was very important to make the program that he does not work too much at home and doesn't get too fit, actually. But at home, he was a fairly uncomplicated horse, I have to say. I think what he brought to the sport is that people enjoyed watching dressage because he made things look very effortless compared to, you see some people who have to spur and drive a lot and work a lot. It always looked, everything looked at ease with him. Everyone said, God, we can hardly see a move because he just seems like he's doing everything by himself. And that was him, because that's how he was. And it seemed like everyone seemed to know him. Whenever I went somewhere or traveled around the country, they said, oh, we know Graf George, we've seen him here, or we saw him there, and he did this and he did that. So it seemed like everyone would know him and had a little story to tell about him. And I think that's good. He was a little hero for the people in this country at this time. And I think that's what he brought to the sport. The special thing about relationship, I think the temperament, my temperament combined with his temperament. I think I'm a very calm, patient person, at least on the horse. And the horse, Graf George, was obviously high-strung, full of himself, with a lot of attitude. And he needed someone just to sit back and wait and let him do his thing and just work with that. And I think that was the right combination. The little things to watch out for, and again, I have to quote Robert, who gave me a lot of little insights because he had known the horse for longer. He said, when you warm up the horse for the show and you think he's ready to go in the ring, he feels tired and he's ready to go, gallop and warm him up another half hour till you feel it's too much and he's too tired. Because when you go around the ring and he hears the whistle or the bell, he will buck and he will get really fresh. And I went to the first show, and I warmed up the horse. He was just beautiful. I could ride him and do everything. Everything was perfect. And he was not fresh, was not tired, just perfect. And I thought, I don't want to do more with this horse. Why stress him more? I went in around the ring. Everything was still perfect. That bell rang. And sure enough, he exploded as soon as he heard the bell ring. And he went in the ring and had at the beginning some mistakes because he was just too fresh. And I think he galloped off on the first diagonal for the extended trot. He jumped and ran off. He came back and then was beautiful for us. But still, so that was the thing. You always had to just give him a little extra warm-up to make sure he's rather tired before he went in the ring, because otherwise he would have been too much horse, just got too fresh. He went in and just gave it all, I have to say, especially in going up to Atlanta to the Olympics. I really myself didn't have any international experience. I did the Pan American Games a couple years before, but that was my only big experience. And then doing the trials with Graf George already, of course you get a lot of experience doing the trials, but then going to Olympics was my first really big show, meeting all the Europeans and everything. And he did not do one thing wrong, I have to say. He went in and it was obviously the atmosphere at those kind of shows and events is very electric and very hard for horses to take sometimes, and he really gave it the best he could at that time. The Grand Prix Special at the Olympics in Atlanta. It just was one of those things that's always stuck in my memory, and I thought he was just so beautiful to ride. He was just, I felt just so one with the horse, and it was effortless. I could have ridden him all day long like this. It always stuck in my mind for some reason. I can't give you a particular reason why. I just, those little things, it just felt so great. He always made you feel like you're a good rider. You know, even if you made a mistake or something, he always made you look good. And that, I like that about him. I think the special thing about Kraft Schwarz, what he did for my career, as I mentioned, it was my first horse I rode internationally, successfully. And I think when your first arrival on the international scene really puts a stamp on your riding and your peers and judges and everyone looks at you as a rider. And I think what he did for me was that he made me look like I just said, like a good rider, and I hope I am, I think I am a good rider, but he really put a little more to that and made that a strong point. So I really felt people looked at me as a good rider because I showed up with Graf George.
In episode 74 of the USDF podcast, you can hear from the owners of Graf George, Dick and Jane Brown. And finally, in our education segment, Beth Belmont discusses some topics from her book, When Two Spines Align, Dressage Dynamics. I began by asking Beth how the concept for the book originated.
I needed to write the book because of my position as technical editor for Dressage Today for many, many years. I was in the very enviable position of being able to call anybody in the world and say, to Huberta Schmidt, how do you do that? How do you create so much power and still keep the relaxation? How do you do this? How do you do that? How do you do a half halt? And I guess after 17 years of interviewing people all over the world, it all makes so much sense to me, the way the rider is able to sort of tap into Mother Nature in a way that makes riding relatively easy, at least in theory, and makes the horse beautiful and happy.
So we're really talking about harnessing the energies, the force, if you will, and the balance at play when you're actually sitting in the saddle and those two spines are lined up. And also, there's the notion of pushing away from the bit. I'd like you to explain, Beth. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'd like to begin with what the horse's hind leg does. And if the rider is able to be a part of each of these things that the hind leg does. First, it thrusts off the ground, and can the rider be a part of that? Create more thrust, create less thrust. And everyone knows, I think, that when the horse thrusts off the ground, the energy goes through the horse's top line and goes to the bit. The horse's hind leg also reaches. It thrusts, and then the second thing it does is reach. And ideally, the rider wants to influence the horse in such a way that he reaches and steps directly under the rider's body, directly under where two spines meet. And when that happens, everyone who rides has had the experience like, wow, it's so easy right now. I wonder why it's not always this easy. And typically, it's easy, and the horse carries himself and you when the hind leg steps right underneath the center of gravity of both of you. And that's really kind of crazy. We're thinking about the ability of the rider to take this foot that's maybe 4 or 5 inches square and putting it in a very precise place. That's actually a little bit easier than one would think, because once the rider starts to try to do that, the horse is pretty happy. He likes it when he's in balance. Horses hate being out of balance. So that second thing that the horse's hind leg does is reach. It thrusts and then it reaches. So far, how can the rider influence the horse's thrust to thrust more or less? Sometimes we always think more, but it's really more or less. And can the rider influence the reach so that the horse steps directly underneath the center of gravity? And then the third thing that the horse's hind leg does is it lands. After it thrusts and reaches, it lands. And we call that the engaging moment. He engages when he carries weight on that hind leg that has landed. And can you, as a rider, also influence that? Can you add weight to the hind leg at that very moment? So this is all about the rider tapping in to that rhythm and song of the horse's movement. And so going back again, that everybody knows about the energy from the thrusting hind leg goes through the top line and goes to the bit. Now, if that's all it did, the horse would become heavy. And when I ask people in clinics, you know, what happens to the energy after it reaches the bit? Most people don't really know, and that's where pushing away from the bit comes in, because the horse does step to the bit, and then ideally he yields and pushes away from it a little bit, carries himself proudly, and at that very moment adds weight to the hind leg and becomes light in front. I don't think it's very well known in this country. You think of pushing away from the bit, sounds like a bad thing, but it's the ideal. It's what perpetuates that circle of energy. I think we've all heard somebody say, my horse is pulling. Well, he actually reaches for the bit, this time with his head and neck. It's a different kind of reach. It's not the same reach as the reach of the hind leg, but it goes together, doesn't it? As the horse reaches with his hind leg, he also reaches to the bit with his head and neck. And from his point of view, he's not pulling, he's pushing on the bit a little bit. And this is a prerequisite to half halts working. He has to go to the bit, and that's something that most horses need to be taught, that when the rider closes the leg, he reaches to the bit. Now, that's sort of like when your telephone rings, you pick it up and you say hello. And that's sort of the same concept. When the rider closes the leg, the horse should reach for the bit. And in that moment, he might become a little tiny bit stronger in the hand, or in some cases, quite strong. And that's when the rider needs to kind of understand the concept of, well, gosh, now this isn't a bad thing that he's in the hand. He's in the handle maybe a little bit too strong, but thank goodness he's there. And this is where a lot of riders make a mistake. They try to get him off the bit. Well, instead, if you think, okay, I'm going to add weight to the hind leg and help him push away, help him learn to push away from the bit and carry behind. So there's a moment of solid contact. Then the horse pushes himself away from the bit and carries himself proudly. Weight gets transferred at that moment to the hind leg. And then he carries himself and thrusts again. So thrust, reach, engage, thrust, reach, engage. Push to the bit, push away from the bit. This way the energy recycles so that work becomes easy. Then, remember when I mentioned thrusting more or thrusting less? I think the very best riders in the world know how to ride forward into downward transitions. And you can't do that if the horse isn't pushing away from the bit. So say you're doing a medium trot down the long side and you'd like to do a collected trot and then maybe even a piaf, get shorter and shorter and shorter. You can sort of, your aids can sort of bounce your horse from bigger strides to littler strides to littler, smaller, and then even riding forward to even on the spot and then forward to, on to longer strides again. It's the same as a jumper is galloping around a speed course, say. He has to shorten the stride before he takes a high fence. The rider shortens it in a forward way. Nobody ever pulled their horse into piaf. They ride forward into piaf. Nobody ever pulled themselves into a canter pirouette. They push into a canter pirouette. So I think not too many people think about, I think this is maybe the one key for riders who are really, really good. They can ride forward at the time that they're bringing the horse back into smaller strides. And this makes a circle of energy. There's a little go and a little whoa in every stride. There's a little go in the thrust. There's a little whoa in the engagement. And sometimes you ask for a little go and then sometimes whoa, and then the aids come very close together, don't they, within one stride. It's go and whoa and go and whoa and go and whoa. And because the horse pushes away from the bit, the energy goes around and around and around from the hindquarters to the bit and from the bit to the engaged hind leg and then back to the bit on and on and on. And this builds tremendous top-line muscle of the horse. You see a good dressage horse has a beautiful top line. And then, of course, when he has the muscle to do it, he can do it more easily and with tremendous expression. And along with the circle of energy, there's the circle of the aids. We've heard of the rider's aids. They ride on this circle of energy in the rhythmic song of your horse's movement. So every stride, there's a little tiny encouragement of the hindquarters, and then a tiny direction of the reach, and then a tiny shaping ability of the rider to shape the horse, and then a little tiny confirmation of the balance on the hindquarters, and then a little tiny soften, and it goes on and on and on. Recycling makes work easy because it's done rhythmically and it uses energy in a very efficient way. And of course, this is all just in theory. In practice, it's not so easy, but it's surprising that what it takes, I think, on the rider's part is a little faith in the system and a little persistence to keep going at it. And, I mean, really being persistent. I remember Kirkland once said, gee, the difference between me and the other top riders in the world is simply that I am so picky about all these basic things, and I'm persistent, and I don't compromise. And the attitude, of course, when I say don't compromise, the attitude is always you're helpful to your horse, you're coaching your horse, you're aids are called aids for a reason because they help. And then Huberto Schmidt, I remember him saying that all riders know about the inside leg and the outside rein, which is another topic altogether, but it's related, of course. And that he puts his horse on a 20-meter circle, and he does trot canter transitions until his horse is on the outside rein. And sometimes, I know because I've seen this, he has to be very quietly persistent about it. And if he's persistent about it, I think most people give up too soon, or they think they can't have it, or whatever. I think it's true that of the best writers I've ever seen, they're just kind of quietly, not unhappily, happily working on these simple things until it works. Because once the horse figures out, once you've really taught him to understand in his head what he's doing, he's going to be happier too, because the horses love being in balance. And that's what we want too.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Beth, for coming on the program and telling us about that publication, When Two Spines Align.
My pleasure.
And you can buy a copy of the book by going to the USDF website's online bookstore. And whilst you're on the website, don't forget to check out eTrack for all the USDF's educational resources. And as always, there's more information on the topics that we cover here on the podcast, also on the website at usdf.org. And as well as being able to listen to the show on the website at usdf.podbean.com, you can also download the podcast from the iTunes podcast store. Just look for USDF. That way you can listen to it on the go on your smartphone or tablet app, of which there are several, including Podbean and Stitcher. Until next week, thanks for your company wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.